Hey, everybody. This is the August 16th, 2016 edition of Inside the Park. I am Steve Gelbs, joining you from Phoenix, Arizona, where it's only about 102 degrees right now. But hey, it's a dry heat. That's what they always say, right? It only feels like 95, 96, 97, something like that. Anyway, good show coming up for you today. Wayne Randazzo, 710 WOR, going to join us actually on for most of the show. Usually we like to keep our guests to one segment. But when you spend as much time next to me on a plane as Wayne does, you have a lot of conversations. And I just thought, you know, one segment, not going to do it with Wayne Randazzo. So we'll get into the state of the Mets. Also, don't know if you guys saw, but last week I had a lot to talk about on the air about the pace of game initiatives, the time of game initiatives with Major League Baseball, how they've kind of taken a step back this year. And it may lead to more drastic changes in the future. So I'll get into that with Wayne as well. And perhaps most importantly, I'm going to give my friend Wayne an outlet to talk about his passion, bullpenning. And if you don't know what that is, that's okay. Stay with us because Wayne is going to give an impassioned defense of why Major League Baseball teams should start to move towards bullpenning. So that's coming up in just a bit. But first, just a reminder, we've now made it easier for you to listen to all of SNY.TV's original podcasts. If you're a fan of the Mets, Jets, Knicks, Rangers, Islanders, or college basketball and recruiting, just subscribe to the SNY.TV audio network on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. That is SNY.TV audio network. Please make sure to rate and review our channel. Unless those ratings and reviews will be negative, then we suggest you stay away. But if it's positive, rate and review. So now that that's out of the way, we bring on the one, the only Wayne Randazzo of WOR 710. Wayne, thanks for doing this, buddy.
Steve, I have nothing else to do here in Phoenix, so it's good to be here in your hotel room and punching away at this podcast.
I want to set the scene for people out there right now. Wayne and I are sitting here at the desk, I guess you would say, of the hotel room. Wayne is wearing a purple Macho Man Randy Savage t-shirt, and to our upper left, we have a light fixture that is basically a bull skull, would you say?
Yeah.
That when you turn it on, the words moo come out underneath it. If you're looking for a picture, I have one on my Instagram at Steve Gelbs. Wayne has one on his Twitter account, I believe. And I think that's the most important place to start. When we entered this hotel, the Camby Hotel in Phoenix, Arizona, what was your initial reaction to the cow skull, the bull skull?
I was shocked by it. It was very jarring. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. It was all lit up. Really, it was the only light in the room when we got in. So that was nice of them to set that scene for us as we entered. And, you know, overall, just a lot of a different motif, a little bit Southwestern, but with a unique modern twist. And it's very bizarre.
And there's some, I don't even know what you call it, above the beds, motivational, call that? There are just lines above the beds of things about sleeping.
Yeah, it's very sleep encouraging, although mine is just a blank canvas with a couple of sentences. Yours has the Prince logo on it, so that's incredible. That's even scarier.
So if you're coming out to Phoenix and you're thinking about staying anywhere other than the Camby, you're doing it wrong. But we are here and we are talking about the New York Mets, who lost again last night. And, you know, I think just overall, the state of the Mets right now, three games back in the wild card, they were 47-38 after July 7th and are 12-21 since. Certainly injuries play a factor, but it has not gone the way the Mets would have hoped at this point. And I think it's important to just start with this topic, Wayne, because so many people have been reaching out to both of us on Twitter, and everyone wants to talk about Terry Collins and is he on the hot seat? Should he be on the hot seat? And I don't know your personal thoughts on it, but for me anyway, I think Terry, with what he did last year and where he took this team, he's earned himself the ability to bring this team out of it, especially given the types of players that are in this lineup right now. I mean, the 5-6-7 hitters yesterday were Wilmer Flores, TJ Rivera, and Ty Kelly. It's not as if he's got all the pieces to work with at this point in time.
Yeah, I agree. I think in a lot of ways, when you think about this season, that you thought you'd have Lucas Duda in the middle of the order. Maybe you wouldn't have Jay Bruce if you did, but maybe you still would. And if you had a 3-4-5 right now, Bruce, Cespedes, and Duda, things would look a lot different. So it is remarkable to me that winning the National League pennant, that taking this team to the World Series. Think about the other managers in Mets history that have gone to the World Series. They're mostly beloved. Gil Hodges, Yogi Berra was just beloved around baseball, all told. And then Davey Johnson and Bobby Valentine. That's the group Terry Collins is in. And you'd have to think that that should buy him something as far as equity with the fan base. It seems it hasn't. And this year has not been what people perceived it would be. Certainly injuries have played a lot of part of that. You look at the opening day starting lineup, 10 guys, including the DH against the Royals that day, and seven of them have been injured this year, not to mention that Conforto and Darnell have, and Granderson does to a lot of extent too, have played well below their expectations. So how do you pin that on the manager? I don't think you can. I think this has just been a season where a lot of bad fortune has come about, and I don't think you can say, well, it's the manager's fault, he's got to go. I don't think Terry's lost the clubhouse, and I think that's the main component to me for if a manager should stay or go.
Yeah, and I think that one of the most fascinating things is a person or a fan base's need at times to place the blame somewhere. And I understand it. It's human nature. But again, and this is to your point, if you were to take, you know, the opening day roster and say, okay, this is where they are right now, but throughout the course of the season, the Mets are going to lose David Wright for the year. They're going to lose Lucas Duda for the year. They're going to lose Matt Harvey for the year. They're going to lose Juan Lagares probably for the year. Zach Wheeler is not going to come back. Michael Conforto is going to take a major step back in terms of a sophomore slump. Yoenis Cespedes is going to try to play through injury for close to a month, and then he's going to go on the DL and miss some time. I mean, you put all of that out there, and I don't know if anybody would have much of an expectation about where this team was going to go. Steven Matz pitching with a bad bone spur. Noah Syndergaard experiencing some arm fatigue midway through the season. So these are all things that, listen, I understand Terry Collins, there are certainly things in-game at times where you can question, but coming off of making the World Series and having this level of things working against him and the team and the organization, I just don't know how you could justifiably make a move at this point, especially when the Mets now are on the verge of getting somewhat healthier and are still amazingly right there in terms of the wild card race.
No, you can't do it now. In fact, it would look like you're waving a white flag because you'd have an interim manager then at that point, whether that be Tim Tuffel or Dick Scott or somebody else. Then you're just looking at finishing the season with somebody other than Terry Collins, knowing that you're going to, in the offseason, find your guy to lead this team for 2017 and beyond. So I think that's a move that the Mets should absolutely not consider now. If they want to consider it for next season, then that's a little different. But I don't think, again, that it should be because of what happened this season. I look at it this way. The Mets are a 500 ball club right now. If those guys were healthy, if they had Harvey, if they had Cespedes, Cabrera, everybody, let's say you take a couple guys out. Maybe David Wright wasn't going to play no matter what this year anyway because of what he's going through. But would that be five more wins? Would that be seven more wins? Doesn't sound like that much. It sounds like with a full group of players that they expected to have, they could easily have five more wins or seven more wins. If that were the case, they'd be the team way ahead in the wild card. If they had five more wins right now, they'd be two games in front of the Cardinals and the Marlins, and the Mets would be the team that people were catching. And the Mets would be the team that had the soft schedule coming up in the last 6 weeks, and that you would say would be very difficult for them to not win at least a wild card spot. So I think if you had everybody, then you would look at this season much more differently.
Jay Bruce was supposed to be the guy that was the Yoenis Cespedes of last year, the trade deadline acquisition that sparked this team and, you know, propelled them forward. 13 games in, hitting just 160 with two home runs. I know people are starting to get anxious about what's going on with Jay Bruce. A couple of things. First of all, with the roster around him at this point, if I'm an opposing pitcher, I have no idea why you would pitch to him. And I think you're seeing that a little bit right now. We saw it with Yoenis Cespedes as the year progressed and the injuries started to take their toll. But a second thing is, and people forget this, we saw something somewhat similar with Yoenis Cespedes when he came over last year. His batting average was better than Bruce's is right now at the start. He was batting anywhere between 250 and 300, depending on how many games you want to go. But he didn't hit his first home run. Cespedes didn't hit his first home run until his 11th game with the Mets last year. He only had two home runs in his first 17 and only eight RBIs. Then he went on that tear, 15 home runs in the next 24. But for Bruce, I mean, for me, it's almost a combination of why would pitchers pitch to him? Plus, there is an adjustment, as much as people don't want to say it. There's an adjustment to a new organization and certainly a different level of pressure on him right now than he had when he was in Cincinnati.
Yeah, there is. I mean, he's won before. He's been involved in pennant races before. The Reds were good at one point, if you can remember those days when they had Dusty Baker, as a matter of fact, as their manager. So he knows what this is like. I also, you know, Jay Bruce is not a big batting average guy. I mean, he's a career 248 hitter. The last couple of seasons before this year were very lean as far as his batting average is concerned. So it's not shocking to me to see him not hitting for a high average. He hasn't hit for much power yet. And I think it will come. I mean, he'd been so good this year that you just had to figure even if he had stayed in Cincinnati, at some point it was going to dip down for him. I mean, he was not going to be a 45 home run, 120 RBI guy this year. That's just unrealistic to expect from Jay Bruce at this point. So I think he'll be fine. You know, we haven't seen him really get many hits with runners in scoring position yet. That's something he's excelled at this year, and it hasn't been there since he's come to the Mets. Also, I think the we've heard Sandy Alderson say this before. These types of trade deadline deals tend to not work. It was kind of rare that Cespedes made it work. You can look back at just a few guys over the last 20 years at the trade deadline that really helped their team. Manny Ramirez, when he got traded to the Dodgers in 2008, went ballistic and helped that team go all the way to the NLCS that year. Those are the types of trades that stand out, but those are rare. We see these trades every year, and hardly any of them work to the extent that the Cespedes trade did. The biggest thing about the Bruce deal was that he signed for next year, and you do know that you're going to have this main bat in your lineup going into your 2017 season.
Wayne, one thing you mentioned with Jay Bruce is the runners in scoring position, that success that he had in Cincinnati and the lack of success he has had since coming to the Mets. It's almost been an epidemic for the Mets this season, hitting just 205 at this point with runners in scoring position, historically low mark for the Mets. And I thought it would be interesting to take a Twitter question from someone, because this is a question that gets posed to us by a lot of people, and it's a point of debate amongst writers, amongst the players themselves at times. But Tom Hubert sent us a question saying, is clutch hitting, is hitting with runners in scoring position a skill, or is it more of a statistic that can fluctuate from season to season, something that you really can't quantify why or why not it's working for a player at any given time? And you know, you talk to enough people, okay, and you talk to Terry Collins, you talk to Keith Hernandez, you talk to people around the league. We saw Miguel Cabrera, what he can do with runners in scoring position, how they change their swings, how these greats at it change their approach at the plate. What is your thought process on it? Is it something where it's just, you know, sometimes you're going to hit with the runners in scoring position, sometimes you aren't? Or is there something to it? Is there a skill associated with hitting in the clutch?
Well, it's a great question from Tom. And I think, too, that the answer could be a little bit of both. I think there is some skill to it. We saw the other night Neil Walker with a man on third, had a full count, a ball was thrown away from him, and he just flicked it in the left field. And he got an RBI out of it. The Mets got a run. And it was a good piece of hitting by Neil Walker in a position where he could have tried to drive the ball and done more damage, got himself in a scoring position, maybe hit a home run. Instead, just kind of flicked the ball the other way and got a hit out of it. I think that there is a mentality to that you need to have. But I also think when you look at the numbers, it does fluctuate. Jay Bruce last year was horrible with runners in scoring position. This year he's top five in the league. Asdrubal Cabrera and Curtis Granderson are having horrific seasons with runners in scoring position, yet you look at their career numbers and it's not even close to that. I mean, they've been much, much better throughout their careers in those spots. So I think there is some sort of mentality you need to have in those spots, but I also think that it can be a lot of luck. Those tend to be small sample sizes. We analyzed Granderson's hitting with runners in scoring position this year. It's only about 60 at-bats. It's not a very big sample size. So you have to look at the long haul of his career to see if he's any good at it. And traditionally, he has been. I remember the Cardinals a few years ago hit like 375 one year with runners in scoring position. And the next year, they came back to earth. And I think the Mets will come back up to earth at some point. It may not be this season, though, and that's frustrating.
I do think, though, just to wrap this topic up, that there is something to, when you talk about the mental side of the game, forget the approach, forget shortening your swing, forget trying to just flick something into left field, right field. I think when you look at what's happened with the Mets this season, even if they want to downplay it, this has been such a topic of discussion amongst the media. So many questions have been asked to these players that it is impossible for them not to think about it in those specific situations. We saw when Asdrubal Cabrera broke that. What was the streak? He was 0 for 32. When he finally got that hit, I mean, he knew that he had finally gotten that hit. So, you know, you talk to baseball players, and so much of the game is mental. And when they go up there, you know, you can't be thinking negative thoughts. And if you're going up there in a spot and you know, okay, here's a runner in scoring position yet again, I have to come through, More often than not, the results will be negative. And I do feel like this has kind of been something that has just snowballed downhill for the Mets this season. I mentioned at the top of the podcast that we would have Wayne Randazzo on for two segments. So let's call that the end of segment one, okay? We're going to move away from the state of the Mets right now and talk more state of the game. We're going to talk about pace of game, time of game, and how that has moved backwards. But before we do, I'm going to give you the spotlight here. I'm going to give you the platform here. If you're around Wayne enough, you know that he is a slightly obsessed, I would say, with the idea of bullpenning in the major leagues. So give a brief overview for people who don't know what the theory of bullpenning is and why you think it should be instituted across Major League Baseball.
I'm not obsessed with bullpenning. I'm obsessed with the fact that baseball holds on to old traditional ways of thinking when those ways of thinking should no longer be in existence. Mm-hmm. And pitching is one of the main ones to me that needs to be analyzed differently because, of course, as we know, complete games don't happen anymore. They did regularly, all the time. A pitcher would get 15, 20, 25 complete games, more than that if you want to go back to the old Hoss Radbourne throwing every inning of every pitch and every of a whole season, okay? Now, things have changed from the times of old Hoss Radbourne through Christy Mathewson, through Bob Gibson, and into today's game where pitchers tend to only go about five or six innings. The average start is around five innings, so you're going to see pitchers. Now, the Mets aren't a good example for this, because they do have pitchers that tend to go deep into games, guys who are considered aces, guys who are considered to be elite starting pitchers. This is not for them. So it's hard to point at the Mets and say they should be doing this. They really shouldn't be. But a team that the Mets played recently, the San Diego Padres, should absolutely be doing this. The Diamondbacks, a team that doesn't have much starting pitching, should be looking into a situation where their starting pitchers need to be protected in a different way. And if your pitching is only going to go about five innings into a game, then your underbelly of your bullpen is going to be exposed. And that's why we've seen the Diamondbacks have such a miserable season. Their starting pitchers go five innings, they bring in some bum out of the bullpen to pitch the sixth, and the game just goes awry. It's a bad situation to be in. So if you look at that, most teams, they should be using their starting pitcher differently. Starting pitchers can't go three times through a batting order much anymore, at least the typical starting pitcher. Think about Logan Verrett, the typical starting pitcher, and going through the order three times. Usually that third time is rough. So what I think that pitchers should do, or that team should do, is have their starting pitcher come into the game later. Come in with that first time through the order almost finished, the seventh batter of the game, the eighth batter of the game, and have the starting pitcher begin there. If he begins in the third inning of a game, or even the second, if the first inning has four or five batters taken out, then that first time through the order, those early hitters aren't comfortable in their second at-bats. They had their first at-bat, they face one pitcher, their second at-bat is against somebody else, and then their third at-bat could be against that same pitcher who's working through the second time. And if he's got four pitches, he should be okay to at least go through times two times through the order.
But just to interrupt for a second, so you're suggesting, and bullpenning at its core is suggesting that those relievers to start the games are who? Are they, you know, your Jerry's Familias? Are they your Addison Reed's? Or are you talking about, like you mentioned, the underbelly of the bullpen starting those games?
I guess it could be either or. My theory is that if you use somebody who's maybe not as good, well, then you still have eight innings to make it up, because people say, well, what happens if he gives up three runs? Well, then he gives up three runs. Bartolo Colon gave up three runs last night. What happened? He had eight innings to make it up. So I think you still have some protection there instead of that pitcher giving up three runs in the seventh inning, and all of a sudden you're down the couple innings left. I think people don't understand that an out is an out. An out is an out in the second inning as it is in the eighth inning. A run is a run in the second inning as it is in the eighth. If you lose a game 4-3 because you gave up two runs in the ninth inning, people will blame the closer. Well, I gave up two runs in the ninth inning. But you also gave up two runs in the second inning. And those runs counted too. And that's why you lost, because you gave up those two runs also. So every out is the same. Every run is the same. And if you look at it that way, then it shouldn't matter. Look how Terry Francona is managing Andrew Miller. Andrew Miller's pitching the seventh inning. He's pitching the eighth inning. He's pitching the ninth inning. He's pitching depending on who's coming up and what the situation is. And I think more managers need to do that. And with regard to starting pitchers, if they're going to pitch five innings, who cares which five innings it is? Why does it have to be the first through the fifth? And I get that there's routines and all that, so you couldn't just ask John Neese to go and pitch the third through the eighth inning. That would be unfair. But I think as you start to develop pitchers, they should be able to come into a game at any time. And I think once you start to develop that in their heads, then it won't be a matter of routine.
See, listen, I understand the argument, and I understand, I love what Terry Francona is doing in terms of matching up your back end of the bullpen with what the most critical situation is towards the end of the game. I've always been a proponent. Why does the closer need to pitch the ninth inning if the heart of the order is coming up in the seventh or the eighth? There may be more critical situations to bring them in during. But if you make an assumption, right, that a starting pitcher is generally only going to pitch five innings. And that's right. I mean, the average starting pitcher across the league does. Aren't you, in some regards, if you start the bullpen early in the game, aren't you, in some regards, almost saying and admitting that we're going to use our bullpen a decent amount in this game when there may be the possibility that that starting pitcher that day could have it and go six and go seven, and all of a sudden in the days afterwards, especially if you're going to do this with more than one pitcher in the rotation, in the days afterwards, you may need some of those guys in the bullpen that you've used without even knowing if you had to use them?
Well, if a pitcher goes seven innings, then he finishes the game. So then somebody else that you might have used later has not been used. So you would still have somebody resting in your bullpen, because if that pitcher just has it that day and goes seven, well, then he finishes the game himself. So you wouldn't even need to bring in another relief pitcher. And with pitch counts anyway, you know you're going to use your bullpen on a given day. I mean, now the Mets have Noah Syndergaard pitching. Well, he might be so good and go so deep into a game where you might not use many people. But again, this is for the pitcher that is on a pitch count of 80, a pitch count of 90, when you know you're going to limit his innings. You know, the Tigers, I think, are talking about right now with Michael Fulmer that, well, all of a sudden it's almost September, and they got to think about his innings limit. Well, they're in a pennant race, and the Mets had to do that last year, and the Nationals had to do that before. So if they thought ahead more that we know we're going to be at this many innings, well, so Strasburg's only going to pitch five. Well, it could be any five innings, and I think you're going to use your bullpen anyway. So at least give your opportunity. Now, Strasburg's not a good example. He can get anybody out at any time. But for a pitcher that can't, I think those are the guys that need to think about, you know, maybe 2.5 times through the order, face the bottom of the order 3 times, the top of the order only twice, and get that guy out of there before things get worse. We saw it in Milwaukee earlier this year. Willie Peralta in the sixth inning. Zach Davies in the sixth inning. These guys in the sixth inning kept giving up home runs. And those would never have happened had the Brewers managed their situation a little differently.
Flip side of all of this, how extreme would you say it could get, or you would want it to go? Because theoretically, you know, you look at most of these starting pitchers, and for the most part, if they were used out of the bullpen, they'd profile even better. I mean, we saw what John Neese did out of the bullpen last year when he got moved there towards the end of the season into the postseason. We see what, you know, how scary Noah Syndergaard could be being used out of the bullpen. Could you ever see, or would you ever be in favor of getting to the point where almost every pitcher on the roster was theoretically a relief pitcher, and instead of pitching every 5 days, these guys could be available 2-3 days in a row, 3 out of every 4 days, and pitch, you know, 2 innings one day, 1 1/3 another day, and you kind of build up those, you know, 9 innings of work. Mm-hmm. based on, I mean, if you could say, okay, here, pitch Syndergaard here for two innings, and then DeGrom for one and two thirds, and then Mats, and then finish it up with Reed and Familia. I mean, would you ever want to see a game get to that point?
I don't think so, because I think you need somebody to be stretched out. And if you see a guy do that, they're just not stretched out to pitch a certain amount of innings. That's part of the reason why you don't see guys complete games anymore. It's because they're not stretched out to do it. Nobody's conditioned to do that. You know, Terry Collins sprinted to the mound as soon as Alexi Ramirez hit that ball down the line. As soon as the umpire said it was a fair ball, Terry was out of the dugout to go get Steven Matz the other day. The pitchers are just not stretched out, and if you do see them get to 115, 120, the sirens start blaring, and oh my God, no, he's not stretched out. He's going to get hurt, and nobody really knows if that's true. It probably isn't true, but it would be even more true if you didn't have these guys at least stretched out to a point where they could handle 75, 80 pitches, and then all of a sudden everybody has a tired arm.
This is a fascinating discussion, and it's one, you know what, we might have you back on at some point, either this year or next, to continue talking about it. I'm being rapt by the people in the studio, and we haven't even gotten to the pace of play, time of game so fast on this. Quickly, if you did not see what we did last week, the basic gist is that both pace of play and time of game have taken a step backwards this year after taking a step forwards last year with the pace of play rules being initiated, clocks in between innings, batters not allowed to step out of the batter's box with both feet after taking a pitch. But it has taken a step back, and mostly because we've seen a lack of enforcement. Baseball doesn't want to go over the top with this. They were hoping that this could be something that was almost self-enforced by the players. It hasn't quite worked. So the question that moves forward is, well, do more extreme measures need to be taken if baseball is serious? And I think that that's where baseball is starting to go. Extreme changes to the game. Perhaps the idea of bringing pitch clocks in, which they use in the minor leagues, 20 seconds in between pitches in Double A and Triple A. They've shaved about 10 minutes off of every game that way. Ideas about maybe limiting pitching changes at the back end. So this bullpenning thing, that's going to extend the pace of game and the time of game, but limiting how many pitching changes you can make, basically by saying a pitcher has to face more than one batter or has to throw at least 30 pitches. One of the ideas set forth is, hey, let's limit the number of pitchers a team can have on a roster. That way they can't have your just left-on-left one-batter guy. And maybe it encourages teams also to carry that extra athletic guy, the speed guy, the defense guy that can give you a little bit more excitement in terms of the stolen base and things of that nature. So, this is kind of a long discussion to wrap up into one or two quick points. But, Wayne, your thoughts on that in general. Do you think the pace, the time of game has gotten out of control? Is it something that baseball really does need to focus on? And are those things that have been put forth as possibilities, would that be going too far? Would that be crossing the line and changing the integrity of the game? Or is it something that, maybe initially would be a bit of a shock, but the same way that a three-point line was originally a shock in basketball, over time it becomes something that people can accept and that does shorten the time and the pace of the game and bring more enjoyment to maybe those fringe fans.
Well, basketball is a great sport to point out to, because not the three-point line, because of the shot clock. Mm-hmm. It changed the entire game. It made offenses have to go. It made teams shoot more. It made points score more. It was such a revolutionary thing, and I think baseball, I don't think they should mess with pitching changes, because I think that takes away too much strategy and also gives too much advantage to the offense in that case. But baseball absolutely needs a pitch clock. It 100% does. We saw Antonio Bastardo take more than a minute sometimes between pitches. It slows the game down to such a horrific rate. There's nothing happening except a pitcher on the mound holding a ball, and that is hideous to watch. So if you have a pitch clock and these pitchers are out there knowing they have to get it and throw it, I think that would absolutely change the amount of action you see and would take away the time of game. I think 10, 15 minutes, a lot of time would come off if he just had one simple solution that I don't think would really change the game in any way except make it better.
You know, Wayne, I was going to talk about TJ Rivera at the end of this podcast by myself. You were too good. I went from this being a podcast where I said, you know what, I'm just going to have Wayne for about two-thirds of it, to I'm going to have Wayne for the entire thing. So I appreciate your time. those fans of TJ Rivera may have to wait until the next podcast to get what I am going to say about him. But I do think that this is interesting stuff, important stuff to talk about, because the game is ever-changing. And as we go on here in the future, whether it's bullpenning, whether it's changes in roster composition, pitch clocks, things of that nature, I do think that over the next 5 years or so, you're going to see a change in Major League Baseball and how the game is played. But Wayne, with his Macho Man Randy Savage t-shirt, and again, under the bright lights of the bull skull, I think we had a nice discussion here today. So thanks for the time, buddy. I'll see you in a couple hours. I think we're having you on pregame today, right?
It's a big day for us, and I can't wait to see you again later.
All right, buddy. Real quickly here, check out the latest episode of the Mets Blog Q&A cast. Matty Cerrone talks with former Mets player and coach Howard Johnson, who is currently managing in the Texas Rangers farm system. Hojo talks with Cerrone about the importance of veteran leaders during a pennant race, how to get young players to learn situational hitting, the pressures of New York City, and the greatest hitter he's ever worked with. To listen to that show and all of SNY.TV Mets audio content, search SNY.TV Mets on the iPhone podcast app, on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, or Audio Boom. And please remember to subscribe, rate, and review the channel. And Wayne, while I have you sitting next to me, do you know what Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Audio Boom, do you know what all of those are?
I don't know Stitcher, but I do know the other three.
I don't know Stitcher. I should have looked last podcast because I said the same thing then. Maybe I'll research that in between this and our pregame hit on SNY tonight. So that's going to do it for this edition of Inside the Park. Thanks again to Wayne Randazzo, 710WR, for joining us. We are back in 2 weeks, August 30th, with another edition. Until that time, thank you for tuning in.
This has been Inside the Park with Steve Gelms, part of the SNY.TV Audio Network.